from McMinnville, Oregon. This is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that likes to eat baby carrots with homemade hummus. I'm Michael Crosser. Of course, you know Chad Tilburg. And today's title is Caught in the James Webb. Hey, Chad.
Hey, Mike.
So we've agreed you are not going to eat your baby carrots while we're actually recording.
No, I'm going to hold off.
But
man, my stomach's a growling.
If that ends up in the recording, the growling part, then maybe we'll okay. Fix that later on. But
okay.
I think we should take our chances with that right there. So,
okay. So you were all a Twitter earlier about some new pictures that had just shown up online.
Yes. The James Webb Space Telescope is finally, they're releasing some of the first images from there. And it's a brand new telescope. So there's a lot of calibrations to be done. There's a lot of work to make them be pretty pictures. The ones that I just sent you a link to, they're blurry and they're not pretty yet. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a few months for them to fine tune everything and get exactly what they want it to be. But it is very exciting that James Webb, I mean, that means that this telescope has been launched into space. It's in its final orbit now. It is unfurled. What's that?
They've got it out of the box. They've taken all the styrofoam from around it.
Yep. They've unfurled this heat shield. And we'll talk about why all of this stuff is cool and interesting. And so it's finally starting to do what it's going to be doing. So it's exciting.
All right. Do we need to talk about who this James Webb guy is, or is that not important?
Well, for those who don't know, yeah. No, so James Webb, yeah. It turns out I had to look this up too, but he was the second director of NASA.
Okay.
So he was actually there. He led NASA during the Mercury and the Gemini space missions. And all those were the missions that eventually led up to the Apollo missions. And so he was, I don't know if he was actually director at that point, but he also ensured that the satellite missions, the Mariner and the Pioneer missions, were both sent through.
Okay.
And those were both missions that sent. So Pioneer in particular took pictures of every single of all the outer gas giants.
So Pioneer, is that the one that is just heading away out of the solar system? And it's just going to keep
heading actually two satellites. Yeah, it's actually two satellites. And apparently he was involved in securing funding for there to be two satellites actually. So at the time they were planning one mission and then they're like, you know, we're almost in this weird alignment of planets that if we could launch a second one, it'd be really cool to do that. We'd be able to hit all these other vacation spots along the way. And so within a year, they sent out two different Pioneer satellites. And
what was the Mariner mission?
So Mariner did the terrestrial planets. So it did flybys of Mercury, Venus, and Mars and got close-up images of those. So, James Webb was very influential in NASA becoming what it is now. And so for this telescope, they wanted to honor him. Have you seen the movie Hidden Figures?
I haven't. I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
He shows up at the very beginning. They're talking about how they need to beat the Russians at something. And he was the one giving this. It wasn't a PowerPoint presentation back then, but whatever it was, he was giving the presentation for it. So
I wonder if I can find that
a character for him. Yeah.
So, okay, then I have a telescope. You have a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And we've looked at through telescopes together a time or two.
Mm-hmm.
But these are obviously Earthbound telescopes. And maybe some of our listeners are aware of and have even been to some of the big observatories around various places, right? Where you've got really big telescopes. Why go to the trouble of launching a telescope up into orbit? What does that accomplish that can't be done here on the planet?
Yeah, well, so there are a bunch of pieces to that, actually. So first and foremost, the atmosphere interferes with a lot of things. So you may have noticed when you look up at the sky, especially at stars that are near the horizon, you'll see them twinkling. And basically what that means is that there are different pockets of air. The atmosphere has these little pockets of air that have different densities. And so as the light is traveling through them, it'll bend different ways and so forth. And so when you see light twinkling, that means at this moment it's going through these pockets of air. And then the next moment it's going through different pockets of air. And so sometimes we see light and sometimes it'll knock out because it's going elsewhere. So when you've got an atmosphere that's like knocking the light around like that, it kind of messes things up. And so you want to avoid twinkling as much as possible.
Okay. And so being up in space solves the atmosphere issue.
Yeah. So that's completely gone. But more importantly for this particular mission, though, is that the James Webb Space Telescope is looking at infrared light. And we'll get into here in a little bit probably why that's important and how that's useful and so forth. But our atmosphere absorbs infrared light very well.
Right.
I mean, you've heard of greenhouse gases and things like that. All of these will absorb infrared light. And since that's what the Webb Space Telescope is trying to look at. We really don't want to be on Earth for that. It's very hard to look at infrared from Earth.
So the space telescope, it's also different from the telescopes you and I have in that it's not taking in visible spectrum light. It's taking in infrared. Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's true. So different forms of light. People have probably heard of, you know, the visible spectrum, the rainbow, Roy G. Biv. On one side of it, we have ultraviolet light. And we have things that are shorter wavelength. And then on the other side, we have things that are longer wavelength, which would include infrared. It also includes radio and it includes microwaves and all sorts of things like that that are not in the visible spectrum. Mm-hmm. But well, so let's get into why we care a little bit about that. And we'll go into more detail here in a bit. So we've talked on this podcast before about black body radiation.
Yes.
Which is basically that everything that has a finite temperature emits some amount of light. You know, it makes sense. Like if you've got an electric stove, for instance, you can actually see it as you turn up the stove. It'll kind of glow an orangey color. Like if you have it on low, maybe it's a dull red color. And then if you turn it up, maybe it'll be a brighter orange color. Uh-huh. And if you turn it up even more, which is what like a tungsten filament light bulb does, then it's a brighter color. It's a more of what we might say white light. And so everything gives off light based on its temperature. So the hotter something is, the more light it gives off. And also the more shorter wavelength colors that it gives off. And so it'll give off more blues and greens. But if you're cooler, you give off things that are actually not even visible in the visible spectrum our eyes cannot actually observe directly.
Okay, that's what I was just going to. When you say that everything gives off light, you're talking about light in the very broad sense of just electromagnetic radiation, even though it's off to one side of where red is. It's off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And some people make a distinction. They'll only say light when they're talking about the visible spectrum.
And but, those people are not physicists.
Well, some of them are physicists, but they're not this physicist. And so they need to just shut up. They don't have a podcast like this.
Okay.
I'm feeling very combative. Apparently, if you have a podcast, you have to be combative and stuff.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well.
But like, for instance, you and I, we're giving off light right now.
You know it.
We're radiant.
I'm glowing.
We're glowing. but the light that we're giving off typically has a wavelength of about like 10 micrometers or so, which is pretty long. Like the visible spectrum is generally what we can see with our eyeballs is generally somewhere between half a micrometer to is around half of a micrometer or so.
Okay.
We generally say from 0.3 to about 0.7 micrometers is the visible spectrum. And so we are giving off light, but the light we're giving off is well outside of what our eyes can actually detect. Mm-hmm. If you've seen the movie The Predator, he can actually see the infrared light. And so, you know, and actually there are some goggles that can see heat light and so forth. They're observing infrared light. So you can see how hot something is just based on that sort of thing.
There are some animals that can actually detect infrared, like pit vipers, for example.
But not through their eyes. Those are through like sensors on their snout or something like that, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so basically, in order to see what's happening out in the universe that is happening at that temperature, we need to be able to see the infrared light of it. And so
does that mean that being on Earth where there's all this black body radiation creates too much light pollution? Is that the idea?
Yeah. So that's a fantastic point there, Chad. So there are two pieces to this. The atmosphere overall will absorb infrared light that's coming from space. But then in addition to that, we do have, I mean, the Earth is giving out infrared light, you know, at about the same wavelength that we're emitting it. And so, yeah, if I had a telescope that I was trying to look at infrared light and I pointed it up, I'd have all sorts of problems because we've got the Earth is creating infrared light as well. You and I are doing it. The telescope itself would be at a temperature where it's giving off infrared light as well. And so the optics of the telescope would also just be creating this extra light that would just be drowning everything out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, all of those reasons, it's a big problem. So we definitely want to send something out into space in order to complete the mission of this telescope.
Okay. And so I feel like I can't remember how many years ago it's been now, but it feels like it's been a while that Hubble was sent up and there's a big, you know, everybody was very excited about Hubble and it seems like we've got a lot of really cool images from Hubble. Why is it possible to revamp Hubble or is it just technologically limited in a way that it made sense to do something completely new and different?
Yeah, those are good questions too. I say without clicking.
Or sounding as surprised. I'm kidding.
Wow, finally. That's a really good question, Chad. Yeah, so Hubble has been fantastic. Actually, Hubble has lasted so much longer than anybody ever dreamed it would.
Really?
And it's still sending back fantastic images and doing amazing research even now. But Hubble is designed for primarily the visible spectrum. Okay. And so Hubble can view light anywhere from about, say, 0.1 micrometers, which is a little bit ultraviolet, up through about 1 micrometer, which is 1 micrometer that would be technically in the infrared, but it's just what we would say the near infrared. So it's, yeah, it's able to see some things, but there's no way that it could possibly see like us glowing. It's not designed for that. And it's not designed for that for a number of reasons. For one thing, the optics are primarily for the visible spectrum. And so I don't know exactly what Hubble is made of, but I think there is the optics itself has some glass in there. And so glass is clear for the visible spectrum, but actually glass reflects some forms of ultraviolet light and reflects other forms of light as well, and actually infrared. And so glass is not a good source for this. And so the James Webb is, the material is actually designed specifically, and the mirrors and so forth are there specifically for this range of infrared. Yeah, so then Hubble is just not designed for these wavelengths. Also with Hubble, Hubble is orbiting around the Earth. Sometimes it's in the shadow of the Earth, which means it gets really cold. And then sometimes it's pointed at things that are pretty close to the sun, which means it's getting like direct sunlight. And sometimes it's pointed away from the sun, which means it's not. And so actually the temperature of Hubble in general could fluctuate tremendously. And they actually intentionally put a heater on there to keep it at about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So like if you went out to Hubble, you know, it's a nice afternoon if you can get inside there, you know? And so they are intentionally keeping it warm because otherwise it would fluctuate. And when things heat up and cool down, you know, they can warp and do all sorts of issues. And so, but having it at 70 degrees means, again, the whole infrared issue that it's just creating too much noise in the infrared. And so, again, you can't really see anything that you would want to see. So, so the James Webb really will be a brand new thing. And actually, it's interesting with James Webb that I mentioned at the very beginning, they just finished unfurling the heat shield. So James Webb is going to be permanently in the shadow of this giant heat shield so that sunlight is never directly touching the optics of the James Webb Space Telescope. That there's this giant heat shield in the way so that it can stay at a very, very cold temperature. And by being at a cold temperature, it's now cold enough that it's not going to create any light within the spectrum of light that it's trying to observe.
So what does that mean that Hubble is missing out on that the James Webb is going to be able to see then? So obviously it's all this infrared, things in the in deeper into the infrared part of the spectrum, but what do we know that's there that we want to get a look at that we can't see with Hubble yet?
So we have telescopes that are able to look in the visible spectrum. We have them that can look at a lot of shorter wavelength stuff. There are actually a lot of telescopes that can look at very, very long wavelengths, like radio waves and things like that. You know, like they're shutting it down, but there used to be was like a giant valley entirely was a telescope in like Puerto Rico. They filmed a James Bond movie there.
I was just going to ask if that was the case.
That was a real telescope, the Arecibo telescope. So,
and now that's a radio telescope. Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
And does it have to be that big because radio waves are so long? Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you think about it, like AM radio waves, the reason that the tower for an AM radio station is so tall, you know, it's like 2 or 3 stories tall, but they have to be that tall in order to emit in those frequencies and so forth. So that's what that telescope is doing. It's trying to collect light in that frequency. So you want it to be pretty big.
Okay.
But yeah, so if we're looking at things that are cooler, then we can actually see some really cool stuff. So for instance, like early star formation, before like fusion really starts, a star is warming up. It's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And then it finally gets hot enough where fusion can actually go. And then it's giving off light in the visible spectrum. But if we can look at light coming from an early star, for instance, we might be able to see some interesting dynamics of what's happening as it's forming.
So question.
Yep.
So early star formation, and you said things are accumulating, but fusion hasn't started happening yet, but it's getting warmer and warmer. What is the source of that heat energy? Is it molecules ramming into each other? And is it those collisions? Like,
yeah, that's exactly what it is. Is that as the collisions are happening, things are heating up a little bit. And I mean, you can actually get pretty warm just from all these objects are crashing into each other and getting bigger and bigger. every time they crash into each other, you're getting extra thermal energy from that.
Okay.
So we could watch, we could see what early stars would look like as they're trying to form these things. Yes.
Follow-up question. But so that kind of thing wouldn't be giving off light in the visible spectrum yet. Is that the case?
Yeah. If it depends how early we're talking. Yeah. So
okay. And so therefore we would only be able to see that by looking in the infrared.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Also, we might be able to see some planets and some other what are called debris disks that might be around a star or something like that, but are colder. I mean, we've talked about before that given our current technology, we probably would not see planets around in our solar system. Like if we were someplace else looking back at our solar system, mm-hmm. I don't believe we'd have the technology to be able to recognize that we are here.
Mm.
So having the ability to see things in the infrared might be able to help us with that. And then probably the most exciting part, though, is that we've talked on here before about how the universe itself is expanding. It's getting yes. bigger and bigger. And with that means that there is something called a Doppler shift happening. That basically Edwin Hubble, for whom the space telescope was named, actually, did a lot of research early about 100 years ago or so that found that when he looked out at distant galaxies and things like that, they were all more red than the light coming from our galaxy, for instance. So okay. if you remember the Doppler effect, we've actually talked about it recently in some recent episodes, but the Doppler yes. effect is how a wave will appear based on the movement of things, right? So if something is moving towards you, then the wave packets are actually kind of squished together a little bit. And so you may notice, for instance, if a car passes you, that when it's coming towards you, the pitch, the sound of the engine or just the tires on the road is a higher pitch than as soon as it passes you, it's a lower pitch.
Right.
That's the Doppler effect.
Right. Okay.
The same thing happens with light. And so things that are moving towards us will have a shorter wavelength, which would be like if we're talking about in the visible spectrum, it would be a bluer color if it were moving towards us. And things that are moving away would have a more red color. And so even though we're talking about infrared stuff, astronomers still use that same designation that if it's coming towards us, it would be a blue shifted. Just meaning that mm-hmm. it's a shorter wavelength. And if it's going away, it's a redshifted. And so mm-hmm. it turns out galaxies are all moving away from us. So they're all redshifted, which means that all their colors are more red than they would be just in the natural, in our galaxy, for instance. And so when he was looking out there and he noticed that the farther away that the galaxies are, the more red that they were shifted. So it turns out then that there are some galaxies that are so far away that in fact, all their light is in the infrared. And so this may actually let us see farther into the universe. It turns out there's a certain distance where like we don't see anything anymore. And it may be that we'd be able to see a little bit farther just for that.
That's cool. Well, I remember everybody was super excited when some of the first images from Hubble came back because I think this is true and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like didn't they point the Hubble Space Telescope sort of at like what appeared to be just a little blank patch of sky and mm-hmm. then left it there to collect the light coming from that little blank piece of sky. And then mm-hmm. when looking at the image, they're just, I don't know, dozens to or hundreds or however many lots and lots of galaxies just in this tiny little blank piece of sky.
Yeah.
And so now what you're telling me is that perhaps in addition to that, there's even more in those blank spaces between those that we just can't see because they're too red.
Yeah. It's kind of mind blowing. Yeah.
That is mind blowing.
But there's a lot of excitement that we would be able to measure even more galaxies out and be able to measure the redshift happening with each of those as well. And so that would give us the opportunity to study even closer to the beginning of the universe and mm-hmm. and see what everything was like even way back then. So so they will be actually measuring a lot of Doppler shifts coming in the near future and trying to see what that means.
Tangential question.
Yes.
You said that Hubble noticed that the galaxies that were further away were more redshifted. How did he know how far away the galaxies were? Was it just kind of like a size thing? Or
so what you have to do, this is kind of a tricky question. What you have to do is have something that we would call a standard candle. Like if you know how luminous an object is, how much light it just inherently is giving off. I mean, you know, like as you walk farther and farther away from a light source, it's going to look more dim.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually does it in a very predictable way. The 1/(distance)² is how it gets dimmer the farther away you are from something. And so if you know, if you can look at a particular star or a particular object and know that this particular amount of light is coming from it, but from where we are, it looks like it's only this much light, then we can say, okay, so it must be that far away. That's how we know about things. And so he had specific stars that he was able to study and get that. And then more recently, people have found other standard candles that have allowed us to look even farther away. So this would be very interesting to be able to continue to study things that are really far away. I mean, in particular, but in recent years, people have been studying how more and more distant galaxies have been, first of all, how fast they're traveling away, which you do by studying the how much is redshifted or how much of a Doppler effect is acting on that galaxy, along with just how far away it is. And so James Webb is going to hopefully answer some questions that have recently come up about that. So we should maybe have an episode about that sometime soon, because it's an interesting question and it gets into things that some people may have heard of, things like dark energy and stuff that a lot of people hear about, but maybe you have a lot of questions about. It would be fun to talk that through.
Yeah, I would be very interested to learn what the heck dark energy is.
Yeah, so there's so much that the new James Webb Space Telescope can look at that will answer all sorts of things, just because it's looking at infrared light and it's looking at things that are colder than just a normal star. And so early formation of stars, early formations of planets and the debris disks and distant galaxies, hopefully it'll bring us all sorts of, not just really pretty pictures and things, but also all sorts of new information about how things start out. So yeah, people are really excited about it.
Yeah, that sounds super cool. And in order to get this sun shield up there, do you have any idea what is that made of and how did they pack it all in to actually get it up there?
Well, so they work very closely with REI. They have these instructions and it's really cool. I don't know how, if they ever want to fold it back up, so like it's going to be impossible.
So like sun shields, they're like over there by the rain flies and after the sleeping bags.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're folded up really tight though. And you have to read the directions 3 times before you can put it back in the bag.
Or you'll never get it back in. Never.
So it is actually kind of cool. They really had this all packed up tightly so that as it was flying out there, it could automatically just by itself unfurl and put everything in place.
So it's like one of those tents that you just throw in the air and it goes, whoop.
Yeah.
Sorry. I can't get off the REI analogy. I'm stuck there now. Okay. Okay. Another question from a dummy here. How big is this thing? Is it bigger than this normal sized room that I'm in, or so what are we talking about?
Yeah. So the diameter is about 21 feet or 6.5 meters.
That's the diameter.
That's the diameter. Yeah.
Wow.
Whereas the Hubble was only about 8 feet in diameter. So this is significantly bigger than Hubble.
And you mentioned that one of the challenges that the Hubble Space Telescope had is that by going orbiting around the Earth, it was experiencing all of these temperature fluctuations.
Yeah.
And so does the James Webb Space Telescope experience that same kind of thing? Is it orbiting around the Earth or what's its story? Where is it?
So it's actually pretty interesting that there's actually an even bigger issue for Hubble. For what we're talking about here is that so Hubble is orbiting around the Earth while the Earth is orbiting around the sun, right? So, you know, we were just talking about how we're trying to measure the Doppler effect of different galaxies and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Well, here's the weird thing about Hubble is that Hubble is orbiting around the Earth, which is orbiting around the sun. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, have you ever ridden on the teacup ride at like Disneyland or anything like that?
Sure.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, you got this big disc and then you've got another disc that's spinning around and then you've got your little teacup that's spinning around. And so sometimes as you're going along, the movement of your little teacup is going opposite the direction of the movement of the big circle. Uh-huh. And so they're partially canceling out the velocities, right? And then a moment later, you're coming around another direction and now they're adding together. And so you get whipped around and
right. So you look at your family who's off to the side and they look all a little blue shifted to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why you feel sick is because everything is blue shifted and red shifted. And yeah, no, it's a horrible ride. Horrible. But so that's exactly what is happening with Hubble. Okay. Because sometimes Hubble is going in the same direction. Its orbit around the Earth is going in the same direction as the Earth's orbit around the sun. So those velocities are adding together and sometimes it's going the opposite direction. So sometimes it's going backwards to the orbit of the Earth. And so then they're partially canceling each other out. And so, you know, if you're trying to measure, if your actual measurement, if what you're trying to do is measure how much of a redshift there is, you are adding on this extra mess at the end of the day, no matter what.
Right.
And so for James Webb, they're like, okay, we don't want to be right there. And so one other option you could have would be, fine, forget the Earth. We're just going to orbit around the sun. Just go around in a nice little circle or a nice little ellipse or something like that. And that's great because that takes care of, you're still orbiting the sun, but you're not getting this extra Earth part in there. Mm-hmm. The problem with that, though, is that then sometimes the telescope might be on the other side of the sun and you have very little access to it. And if you want to send it like a new message, like, oh, I want you to fix this, there's delays and there's all sorts of issues like that. And so that's not ideal. I mean, you kind of want it to be somewhat close-ish to the Earth so that you can communicate with it and just have it nearby so that if anything goes wrong, maybe theoretically we could fix it or do something like that. So it turns out they've put James Webb into a very specific orbit, which is completely awesome that we have this. So it turns out if you're orbiting around, say, the sun, depending on how far away you are from the sun, you have to go a certain speed. Uh-huh. Like, for instance, Mercury is the tightest orbit to the sun. So it's going the fastest of all the planets are. It has to go faster. Otherwise, it would just spiral into the sun and crash.
Okay.
Right? So to be stable, it has to be going a little bit faster. Then Venus is outside of that. So it's going slower than Mercury, but faster than us. And then we're going slower than Venus, but we're going faster than Mars and Jupiter and all these others. And so, you know, if we were to put James Webb just in an orbit around the sun, if it were closer to the sun than us, it would have to go faster. And so it would get away from us. Mm-hmm. If we were back behind us, it would go slower. So we would miss it that way too. However, it's interesting because if you are just a little bit inside of the orbit of the Earth, then as it's going along, it's trying to go faster, but the Earth itself will actually tug on it just enough to kind of keep it in the right orbit.
Oh, so the Earth of the gravity of Earth sort of forms kind of like a leash on it that keeps it from getting away.
Yeah.
Huh. And so how far away is that? Is it well outside of the orbit of anything else we've put into space that we intend to kind of stay local?
Yeah. I mean, the James Webb is outside of the moon's orbit. The moon's orbit is only like about 400 kilometers away, but this is like 1.5 million kilometers away from us.
So it's over three moon distances away. It's almost four moon distances away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so I gave the example of being closer to the sun. So it turns out if we only had three bodies, if we only had the Earth and the sun and none of the other planets, it turns out there are these little pockets that are created there, named after a mathematician named Lagrange. So if you are inside the orbit of the Earth, there's this little pocket. We actually already have a satellite there. And anyway, that pocket is called L1. You don't have to know. But there's a second one, which is where James Webb now is, which is outside of our orbit. And so it's the same thing. It's slowing down, but then the Earth is actually tugging it and keeping it in the correct orbit right there.
Okay.
So it's a very interesting that we're using both of these orbits just to kind of get rid of the herky-jerky motion that things might otherwise create. Just for some fun, there are a total of these five Lagrange points that mathematically exist. Okay. And it turns out that the so-called L3 would be exactly opposite to the sun from us. So that you could have a spot where, like, maybe there's another planet that we never see because it's exactly opposite the sun from us.
Okay.
And then there are two more spots called L4 and L5. And it turns out these are real things. So Jupiter, being the largest planet, has the largest gravitational pull like that. There are a bunch of rocks. There are a bunch of asteroids in the orbit of Jupiter in these two pockets, the L4 and the L5. Anyway, that's cool, but detailed and technical and confusing. But it's really awesome that they're able to choose this one halo orbit that just kind of sticks around in this one spot. And so the Earth, every once in a while, as you said, it has a leash on it, just like tugs along and says, no, come on, come with us. Here, boy, come on. But that's a tiny little tug compared to the herky-jerky motion that Hubble is going through. So,
right. Very cool. Excellent. So any idea when we're going to start expecting to see more images other than the calibration images?
It's going to be a few months still. They're going to, you know, I'm sure they'll keep sending out things just to try to keep the public interested, but I would not look for it for months to even a year to get like the really cool, the things of that you think of like with Hubble, of like the pillars of creation and some of these just iconic pictures that they've sent back. I would not look for that for months to even a year.
All right. I'll have to be patient.
I know. That's the problem with science, right? But it is something that I would expect that in the years and, dare I say, decades to come, this is going to be adding important pieces to the puzzle of our understanding of the universe and stuff. So,
all right. Well, thanks for that, Mike.
Yeah. This episode was recorded on the beautiful campus of Linfield University. Rodi Ortega wrote our theme music. If you like this episode or others like it, you should subscribe to the podcast. That way you'll download the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, leave a comment and a rating, and that'll help other people find our podcast. If you have a question or an idea for a future episode, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Until next time, thanks for listening.